Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our special Lockbox Roundtable edition. I'm Joe Donahue. It's very nice to have you with us. Certainly very nice to hear from both Sarah and Ray as we move ahead and try to fill the lockbox as quickly as we can. Obviously, WAMC can do a lot. We can introduce you to new worlds and expand your knowledge on a topic and even change your mind. But your donation will make sure that all of that actually remains sustainable. That is why we are here this morning. We did not want to interrupt too much of the roundtable panel, so we will be doing that this morning until just a little bit, about 10:45 or so. And then we're going to hear from NPR's Mary Louise Kelly, who has a fascinating new podcast out on national security, which is really interesting and obviously sort of the order of these days. So we do all of that. Let me introduce the group to you and we will get started. We welcome Dean of the College of Emergency Preparedness, Homeland Security, and Cybersecurity at the University at Albany. Bob Griffin is in the house. Hi, Bob.
Good morning, Joe. Good morning, everybody. So tomorrow is 9/11. So I just want to remind people to take a minute and reflect on what happened. Certainly the losses, the bravery, how it changed our society, and you know, sort of ask yourself a simple question: are we better today than we were on 9/11? And where are we going as a society? So it's a day of reflection, certainly something that's near and dear and close to my heart.
This is far from an original thought and has been talked about for many, many years, but you think of how the country came together in those moments after that horrific event, and you think of how we can, without a tragedy, of how we can replicate that and be a people who are working together with a common goal.
Fundamentally different than where we are today.
Yeah.
Very, very much so. Hopefully we don't have to have a tragedy in order to bring us together again as a country.
And we had it, but then we lost it quickly. And you think, oh, well, is there a lesson to be learned? And if there seems to be a lesson to be learned, it is that we can come together. And we did, and we did it very quickly. Mm-hmm. And now, as we go on, we can look back at those times and see. It's always a day where you're sort of mixed with having to watch the video or not, or choosing not to, or reading those stories, and it's just remembering how horrific all of that was. Way to get us off on a good note there, Bob. Thanks. Mark Grimm is here, professional speaker, speaking coach, and Albany County legislator. Hello, Mark. How are you?
Good to be with all of you.
Very nice to have you here. I appreciate you taking part in the program, as always. Also, executive director of Communities for Local Power and former White House advance lead, Anna Markowitz joins us. Hello, Anna. How are you?
I'm doing great. It's a beautiful day. Kids are back at school. Life is seeming great.
Yes, it actually seems like sort of how it should be, right? Mm-hmm. Well, good morning, all. Welcome. And we welcome your letters, as always, panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. While we're talking, don't forget the lockbox. Give now and help as much help as you can give. WAMC.org. WAMC.org. Let's go to our stories for today. And really, I want to talk about the Supreme Court and a pair of stories. And we can separate these, although I'm going to kind of mush them together in the beginning, and then we can take them apart and look at them in their own. First of all, we want to talk about the fact that the Supreme Court is going to weigh the legality of Trump's tariffs in an economic case. The Supreme Court announced that it will quickly weigh the legality of most of President Trump's sweeping tariffs, a far-reaching case that could determine the fate of a cornerstone of the president's agenda and alter the course of the U.S. economy and global trade. The justices asked the government and a group of small businesses and states to expedite briefings in the case, setting a deadline of September 19th, which is not far away as it is only September 10th now, to submit them. The case has been set for argument the first week in November. So this is definitely being fast-tracked. The Trump administration asked the justices last week to quickly overturn a split decision by a federal appeals court that ruled the president could not impose the import taxes under a 1977 law that grants him emergency powers over the economy. The tariffs have been the central feature of the tumultuous trade war that has defined Trump's second term, creating wide-ranging and unpredictable efforts for businesses and consumers alike, as the president has repeatedly announced, then paused or modified levies on goods from other nations. Trump has argued tariffs will help end the fentanyl crisis, rebuild American manufacturing, and save jobs. But the moves have unsettled investors and stoked concerns about the U.S. economy and inflation. That reporting from the Washington Post. The other, so we'll talk about that. And then there is the story of the Chief Justice acting on his own and issuing an administrative stay, pausing a trial judge's ruling while the full court considers the matter. Will that on foreign aid? We'll get into that in just a few moments. But when it comes to the tariff case, Bob Griffin, let's start with you.
Yeah, so I think that, I mean, the tariff case is interesting on a couple of different levels. To me, is it really comes down to the court better defining what the emergency powers of the president are. I have felt for a long time that the president has misused his emergency powers, and that the power to implement the tariff system that he wants really belongs with Congress. And I think this is part of the story of if Congress isn't going to stand up for its powers, will the court? My bigger concern is the president is more than willing to use and frankly abuse executive power. But I'll go back to a real basic premise, Joe, is that the powers of Congress aren't Congress's, they're the people's. And the fact that Speaker Johnson and the majority leader Thune are not standing up for the rights of Congress, the rights and responsibilities of Congress, I think is a real problem. Back to the court. You know, in my mind, it's a hard leap to link tariffs and fentanyl. It strikes me as that you could cherry pick almost anything and say it's an emergency and therefore I should be able to use emergency powers. I think it's almost laughable to be able to for the government to be saying that somehow the tariffs are linked with, you know, the overall economy, given what's happening in the crashing basically of the economy. I will say again my concern about the court. On the court itself, its role that it has in, frankly, reshaping policy, reshaping laws. I think it has gone too far in frankly, in interpreting on its own what policy should be, and frankly, is going to go down in history as one of the worst courts that we've seen. With that said, you know, Joe, in a very weird way, SCOTUS, the Supreme Court ruling against Trump might be the saving grace for Trump and the GOP right now, because it gets them out of the morass that they are now in with tariffs and what it's doing to the overall economy. So there's this perverse, this almost sort of perverse incentive for them to rule against Trump right now, because it may be the only saving grace for the economy.
Anna Markowitz.
I mean, I think it's particularly rich to use a emergency order on the economy when we're at an all-time high in the stock market. We have unemployment that's at historic lows. It just, it's a blatant power grab, just like a lot of his other emergency executive orders. And I would love to see the Supreme Court, have a backbone on this, but I think that I had hopes that it would on many other rulings up to the state, and I've been disappointed every time. They have stripped protections for migrants who are trying to escape war. I am not hopeful, and I think it could be really actually devastating to the economy. It's weird that he's using an executive order to save the economy when it's already good and might be imposing actions that will actually tank the economy. But here we are.
I hate for this to be self-indulgent. During the lockbox introduction of both Sarah and Ray, they were talking about the broadcast that we did from Lake Placid. And the second hour, 10 to 11, that we did was on trading with Canada, cross-border trade, and the impact not only on Canada but on the United States. And if you did not hear that and see what impact it's having, I think it's really interesting to hear people from all sides talk about just how devastating that has been in the very short term, and quite concerned as to what it could mean for the long term. Mark Grimm.
Yes. Well, first of all, this isn't about whether tariffs are a good idea or not. That's not what the court is being asked to decide. They're being asked to decide what the level of authority is for the president and the Congress. And one thing presidents have in common, Democrat or Republican, is they all want more influence. But you know what? Congress is the same way. So our system is based on having the Supreme Court make the ultimate decision. My concern is with lower courts, who are oftentimes are more concerned about their political philosophy and advancing their political philosophy than they are interpreting the Constitution. So let's see what the Supreme Court has to say. They are the final arbiter. That's the way the Constitution was written. And they ultimately will decide just how much authority with regard to the tariffs that that President Trump has. But this really is an issue about whether you like tariffs or not. It's about whether or not the president can exercise what he claims is his authority under emergency circumstance, which, that's open to criticism because how long does an emergency last? But these are all questions that the Supreme Court is going to have to evaluate.
I understand the legalities of it, but we do have to take into account of what impact it's going to have on the economy.
Not in this decision. The decision is, does he have the authority to do it? That's what the Supreme Court decision is about. Is it legal? And then that's another question, whether the tariffs are going to work. Well, there's a time when we didn't have a U.S. income tax. Our nation was funded by tariffs. So this is not necessarily a new thing. Biden used tariffs. The question is, to what extent does the president have the authority to use tariffs in the way that he is? And that's a fair question. That's an open question, and that's yet to be decided.
But where I agree with Mark is that it's about emergency powers, and it's and really what I'm hoping is for clarity on or at least some parameters about the use of executive orders to by fiat implement sweeping changes to policy and laws. And this absolutely affects tariffs because that's how we put the tariffs in. And if we're going to talk apples to apples, Mark, you got to say tariffs that were put in were put in the past with in conjunction with congressional actions versus this time, which is all through executive orders. But it also affects other executive orders that he's put in. I mean, Trump has come in with a slew of executive orders, basically implementing elements of Project 2025 that should have
should have gone through congressional review and vote. And frankly, I think Congress should have to vote. They should have to go on the record to say, yeah, we support this, that we support tariffs as a way of manipulating or controlling the market. That it's within their right. Okay, and what we're doing right now by sort of doing this wink and a nod between Johnson and the Speaker Johnson in the White House is that members of Congress aren't being held responsible to put their position on the line. So the people that we vote for to go to represent us aren't representing us because it's frankly they're not given an opportunity. And that's a fundamental shift in how the country is working. And Mark, you're right. Every single president wants more authority. And I think the difference I see today versus where we've seen in the past is that I think the use of executive authority, the use of executive orders, is so different and troubling to me that I don't know where we come back from, but. The Supreme Court's decision on this is going to have ramifications even beyond tariffs. It's going to get into the idea of the executive orders about the use of military, the blinding to posse comitatus. There's a whole host of changes that have been made in this country by the single signing of an executive order, which is not, in my mind, what the founders intended or what the democracy was intended with this balance of powers.
We're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll continue, and we welcome your letters as always. panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. Don't forget, WAMC's lockbox is open right now, ready for your gift of support. Trusted news, inspiring stories, a stronger community. That's what your support makes possible at WAMC. A monthly gift, $8, $10, $12, whatever works for you, you can do it. WAMC.org. We'll continue with this special edition right after this short break. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion on this Lockbox Wednesday. And we welcome you. We welcome you to get in on the discussion that we're having, WAMC.org. We welcome you to take part and to help our Lockbox, WAMC.org, WAMC.org. And we welcome you to sit back and listen to our conversation, because these conversations are so important and we're so happy to have them and want to continue having them, which is why your support is so necessary. We are talking about the Supreme Court. We are talking about a case that the Supreme Court has fast-tracked that will be looking at the issue of tariffs. We just heard from Bob Griffin. Mark, you wanted to add a few words?
Well, I just think that people that they don't like the Supreme Court if they have decisions that they don't like. They're more supportive of the Supreme Court. We have to let the Supreme Court do the thing. It's not like it's easy to become a Supreme Court justice these days. I remember the votes typically were 98-2 and whatever. That those days are long gone, and there's so much vitriol in politics today, and it's all about destruction, trying to destroy the other guy, and that's frustrating. But ultimately, the Supreme Court has to decide on these things, especially on the executive orders, as you guys had mentioned. Are we going to, the blue state AGs are suing everything that Trump tries to do. So, the litigation is only going to be increased. But ultimately, somebody has to, on legal issues, make the final say, and that's what the Supreme Court's going to do.
Paul writes, Mr. Grimm, there is no need to take a swipe at the lower courts and suggest they are acting politically as opposed to legally. I trust their judgment to behave as they were trained. And if some of those rulings are against Trump's agenda, then they have a good reason to act in that way.
Yeah, I don't trust their decisions. I think they are more, in many cases, political. And that's a shame.
So you don't like their decision?
Well, some of them, yes. I think Democratic appointees have been more inclined to use to rely on political philosophy rather than the Constitution. Conservative judges, I think, are more constitution-oriented, that the basis of their conservatism. And I think you see that playing out in all of the courts.
I mean, but obviously by design, it seems to me it's obvious anyway, by design that this Supreme Court is a very politicized Supreme Court.
Why do you say that?
Well, because every decision is 6-3.
Yeah.
Well, then the three are politicized. I mean, you know, why are
the six are politicized?
You know, if the liberals all vote in a block, why they're not politicized? I mean, the reality
is the Republicans are also voting in a block.
Not always. In fact, Roberts saved Obamacare, and Amy Coney Barrett has issued some decisions that were not along with the conservatives. So, the liberals on the Supreme Court vote more almost. Always vote as a bloc. That's not the case with the six so-called conservatives.
My complaint with the Supreme Court is actually a little bit different. My complaint about the court goes back to Merrick Garland's potential nomination to the court and Mitch McConnell blocking it, fundamentally blocking it, and then saying that he wouldn't do something similar, you know, that if there was ever a time where another Supreme Court justice passed away, that he wouldn't support it close to an election, you know, that he would do the exact same thing so that it wasn't a partisan, and then turn around and stuff the nomination through again. So I look at the court as frankly unbalanced because of the machinations of Mitch McConnell and the appointments.
Back to letters.
I'd also argue that the process has become so bad that all of the nominees hide behind the, well, I'm not going to. There's a term that they use to say I'm not going to answer your question.
It might come
before the court. Yeah. So therefore, I don't want to. It's not like the court's recusing himself. I mean, I think about the situations where, like, I think Clarence Thomas has enormous conflict of interests and hasn't recused himself. So I mean, I think the court has really some enormous ethical issues. I think the partisan issues certainly are in place. I actually have viewed in the past, even with more conservative justices, felt like the best interest was not partisan, but was in the best interest of the country. And I don't believe that this court has that. And I mean, just look at the findings of Citizen United and things like that. They have fundamentally screwed up this country. Mm-hmm.
We have letters. We go to Andrew. We have an illegitimate and openly corrupt Supreme Court. Why should we trust them? They are just as political. Then we go to Polly. We used to be able to rely on the Supreme Court to protect and preserve our Constitution. Oh, well, says Polly.
Can I just ask you, the listeners, why did they feel that way about the Supreme Court but not about lower court judges? Are they somehow vastly different people?
I think they're equally political, right? I think that the Supreme Court is just as political as the lower court judges. They all, take the same oaths to be, following the Constitution and are not supposed to be political. But everybody has opinions. Everybody is a human. And I think we're seeing this in action at the Supreme Court level because, a lot of them are Republicans appointed by Republican presidents. And now we're seeing them make rulings, that are aligned with Donald Trump.
Yeah. I mean, I think the buck stops with them. I mean, it's the same way that Trump gets either the credit or the blame for what goes on within the executive branch, or the fact that I hold my elected representatives, whether it's you on the county council or members of Congress, rather than their staff. even though the staff are the ones that are doing the majority of the work. And I mean, that's sort of the natural inclination is that while the lower courts certainly matter, the big ones that really reshape the country, the decisions are the Supreme Court decisions.
But they were chosen, all these justices were chosen legally through an arduous process, an almost crazy process. And the makeup of the court is a reflection of how voters have voted for presidents in the past, because X amount of presidents gets X amount of appointments based on their terms in office. So it's not like they dropped from the sky. They had an extreme vetting process. And the Supreme Court is there because ultimately people voted for more Republican presidents and they got more appointments. But all judges are politicians. You don't get to be a judge unless you get elected or you get appointed by other politicians. So I don't think anyone is perfectly divorced from any political view they might have. But I just think conservatives, by their nature, or more constitution-oriented, and liberals are more interested in social change, and they feel like they're doing the right thing. But I think that's been my experience.
Well, and I think today's world it's a little bit different. I don't think a conservative movement really exists anymore of any substantive power. I think it's the MAGA movement. I think the social manipulation is just as bad, if not worse, than what could be blamed on the liberals. And frankly, I think the Constitution is a document that is being generally ignored down in Washington right now. And again, I'll go back to a comment that I made earlier, is that the Congress isn't fighting for its own rights. All right. I mean, part of the issue that I have with the emergency powers is that Congress should have stepped in and they didn't.
We are going to take a break. We're going to go back to Lockbox Central for a few moments and do some business. Before we do that, we welcome you to write to us to continue the conversation. We'll talk about Justice Roberts and his action when we come back, and other issues as well. In the meantime, help the Lockbox, WAMC.org. Give now at WAMC.org. The music of Rat-a-tat this morning. You know, you all find they're just both Ray and Sarah were just talking about, you know, finding the thing that is just so important to you and supporting it and loving it and making sure that it stays on the air. And for me, it should. I'm suggesting perhaps the bumper music, and for God's sakes, Rat-a-tat. Yes. Also, we have a playlist. Support that. You can support the playlist and go to the playlist at WAMC.org, WAMC.org/playlist. And we would love to have you check out the music, but also continue the support on the radio station. I misspoke, by the way. It's WAMC.org/roundtable. And the playlist is there. All right, let's get back to our discussion. We're talking about the Supreme Court. We have a wonderful group of individuals with us this morning who are helping us make sense of things that often don't seem on the surface to make sense. Bob Griffin is here, Dean of the College of Emergency Preparedness, Homeland Security, and Cybersecurity at the University of Albany. Professional speaker, speaking coach, and Albany County legislator Mark Grimm joins us, and Executive Director of Communities for Local Power and former White House advance lead Anna Markowitz is with us. And again, we welcome you, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. We started off talking about the Supreme Court and their decision to take on a key economic case dealing with tariffs and that being fast-tracked at the request of the administration. The other story I wanted to bring up about what is happening within the walls and halls of the Supreme Court: Chief Justice John Roberts on Tuesday temporarily paused a federal judge's ruling ordering the Trump administration to pay out $4 billion in foreign aid that has been appropriated by Congress. The Chief Justice, acting on his own, issued an interim administrative stay of the ruling and ordered the challengers to file their brief by Friday. The full court is likely to rule on whether to issue a longer pause soon after that, probably next week, in a convoluted case that centers on presidential authority and Congress's power of the purse. Chief Justice Roberts's order noted that the money is the subject of a proposal from the administration pending before Congress. That proposal, known as a pocket rescission, I won't say anything, is a legally untested effort to claw back appropriated money by waiting so late in the fiscal year to make the request that lawmakers do not have time to reject it before the funding expires. It could make the court challenge moot. The fiscal year ends September 30th, before the 45-day period in which Congress is required to consider a rescission request from the White House. Republicans could bring the matter to a vote sooner, but party leaders have shown little appetite for resisting the president's spending demands and asserting their own prerogatives. To me, Mark Grimm, as I listen to my own voice reading those words from the New York Times, the word that comes out loud and proud is convoluted.
Oh, yes. It's complicated. You know, and I've been involved in, I've gone over, but I'm the ranking member of the Finance Committee on the Albany County Legislature. Oftentimes, budgets are approved, and at the end of the year, money isn't spent. In fact, when I worked for the state for a short time, people would say, oh, they told us they got to spend the rest of the budget, or else we're not going to get our full budget next year. So the idea that money remains unspent in a budget is not unusual. It happens just about everywhere. So but once again, the question is, where's the legal authority between the president and Congress again? And we're having endless skirmishes about this. And in some ways, they're healthy, because otherwise we would just have, authoritative government where there are no checks and balances. So some of this fighting is actually a good sign of a democracy. But I think the vitriol between the two parties is really kind of getting in the way of advancing improvements, and that's kind of unfortunate.
Bob Griffin, given the truncated nature of this and the deadlines that are looming, why do you think that Justice Roberts felt that it was important to act in this way?
What my gut is that Roberts is hoping that this is going to go away, and that they aren't going to have to act on it. I hope the Supreme Court does take up the whole question of a pocket rescission, because it really becomes almost akin to a pocket veto, to a line item veto. And I guess my concern is that, Mark, you're absolutely correct that money does, and that it does, it takes time for government to spend money, especially with procurement processes and open meeting laws and all of the requirements. At the same time, what worries me about this is a president or an administration saying, I don't like elements of this, or I'm going to punish it after Congress has duly passed a law. And this, again, I think you're right, Mark, is that this gets into this whole question of balance of powers. What I don't know is, what happens when the Supreme Court were to say, no, you can't do a pocket rescission, that you should have been expending that money, and legally you must do that. How do you force the executive branch to do that? Because basically what this allows is that with a wink and a nod, the president is just going to implement what and where he wants, and we're seeing that right now. We're seeing red states being benefited at the expense of blue states. We're seeing a level of partisanship that again, I agree with you. I think it's absolutely toxic and is getting worse. This is but back to Roberts, Joe. I really do think that he's hoping that they can step in right now, but this is going to be resolved through the budget process, and they are not going to have to make a decision on a really, really sticky situation, and that is going to have enormous consequences about the balance of power.
Anna?
Yeah, I agree that they're going to wait it out. If I were them, that's what I would do. Why would you want to go on the record if you don't have to, and you can just get away with what you want just quietly? So I think that's what's definitely going to happen here. But yeah, I think that this is yet another test of what can the president get away with without Congress's approval. They're supposed to have the approval of the purse, and this is money that was already appropriated, and now they're going back and retroactively deciding what they want to fund and don't want to fund. And, you know, I don't personally think that that should be allowed. They will have the ability to use Congress to fund their priorities moving forward. You know, it just seems to be a tool to get as much power as possible to also be looking backwards and clawing back money at the same time.
And the big thing to me is that the Congress has the right to go in, and we've seen it, right? And to set a budget, but then also go back and change it. I mean, the idea of clawing back money is well within the right of the legislative branch, and that's at every level of government. Yeah. The question is, and this is why it's so fundamentally difficult, is that where is the line of the executive branch to faithfully follow the direction of the law even when they don't like it? And that becomes, you know, really, really a difficult situation. But if an administration, whether it's at the county level, state level, or federal level, where they just say, hey, listen, you know something, I don't care what the legislative branch has passed and laws are on the books, I'm not going to do it, that's not a democracy.
Well, I think the chief executives everywhere, times change. Say the revenues are way short coming in for the year. They've got to say, we got to save money. So where can we save money? So I do think they have a right to reduce spending. They don't have a right to create spending without authorization from the Congress or from the legislature. But to say they don't have a right to reduce spending when it's necessary because the revenues are really short, I think they have that ability. Now, of course, the Supreme Court is going to decide for themselves. But I think that's part of an executive job, is to keep a handle on the budget.
But as a representative of the legislative branch, Mark, do you feel that the executive should have to come back to the legislative branch for approval when they're making large changes to the budget?
Well, when you say changes to budget, if there's
so something reduction, saying that okay, you're you know, they're seeing money isn't available, we need to make reductions. Don't you see that as a partnership between the legislative and executive branch?
Yes.
But this is the question, right?
Yeah, I think this is something that ideally they could resolve this by going to Congress and saying this is what we want to do.
Exactly.
But there is the question is, what is the level of authority for the chief executive? And that's a difficult question.
Yeah.
That's a difficult question, which the courts ultimately have to decide, especially now where Trump is getting sued every day by a blue state, you know, just because they don't like Trump. So that's really the question. Ideally, you want both of them in sync, but they both have their own interest. And the executive submits the budget and is responsible ultimately for the way it ultimately comes out. And times circumstances change. Do they not have to deal with changing circumstances, I think, is yes. But ultimately, we'd like to see more cooperation between those two branches.
I do think it's a tough pill to swallow to say, oh, well, revenues are so short right now, so we have to cut, you know, Medicaid and SNAP and foreign aid, when at the same time, in the same breath, they just issued a budget that gave trillions of dollars of tax breaks to wealthy individuals. It just, you know... is it really about the money shortfall?
Well, wait a minute. These so-called tax breaks were approved by Congress, and there was quite a battle.
Yeah.
So, you know, they were approved.
Mm-hmm. But that's not the – see, and I agree with you, Mark. You're right that the big, beautiful bill –
It wasn't so beautiful.
It was messy, but I can't say the words that I would call it on air because Joe would get fired.
Have enough money to try to raise.
Bob, I call democracy, Bob. The Congress approved it, the president signed it.
So absolutely. The question though is in other elements of the budget, okay. That's where these pocket rescissions are coming in. So Voight and folks in the Office of Management and Budget are purposely not expending money in areas that they don't want to, even though it was appropriated and directed by Congress. And I think that's a really important and important point for everybody to think about is that all of the cuts that we were just talking about, as much as I don't like a lot of them, that was done through a legal budget process. It's these pocket rescissions. It's this idea that I'm going to purposely not fulfill my legal and fiduciary responsibilities as the executive branch to carry out the law the best way possible, wait it out, and then not expend it.
So isn't it the question, what is the legality of these pocket rescissions? Isn't that the answer we need from the court?
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. And that is a huge question. It's also one that gets into, again, either constraining or expanding the powers of the executive, which is back to your question a little bit earlier, Joe. This is why Roberts doesn't want to be anywhere near this one if they can help it.
We just have about 5 minutes or so before we go over to Lockbox Land, and I want to read a couple of letters from listeners on these subjects. Adrian says, the composition of SCOTUS is pointedly not a reflection of the presidential elections, as the appointments of Gorsuch and Barrett should rightfully have been made by Obama and Biden, and we have observed in plain sight that Thomas, Alito, and Kavanaugh dwell in a moral wasteland. Furthermore, anyone that claims that constitutional originalism is not a smokescreen for a political agenda is either naive, a liar, or both. That from Adrian. Then we go to Charlie, who says the Supreme Court lost credibility with presidential immunity. It isn't political. They aren't loyal to the Republican Party. They are loyal to Donald J. Trump. Then another letter, and this one not having to do with the Supreme Court, but going back to Bob's remarks earlier in the program having to do with 9/11. And Francis says, with your first guest's prompt, I feel compelled to share that one thing that sticks with me since 9/11 is that we had all the intelligence we needed to stop it. We just didn't treat it. We didn't just treat it credulously and did not believe all the literal threats and reasons Osama bin Laden gave leading up to it. We did not need nearly any of the escalation in curbing liberties, expanded executive authority and surveillance powers that we have pushed through in every administration since, and that has led directly to this moment. Bob, thoughts on that?
I think that's a very, very valid comment. I mean, it was a failure of it was a sweeping systematic failure of multiple different agencies and responsibilities of government that led to 9/11, including and I think an overall arrogance about our own safety and lack of imagination. In capacity, and I do agree with the letter writer that the knee-jerk reaction to the horror of 9/11 was a series of laws, including the Patriot Act, that in past times I understood and supported, and now I'm looking at and saying I think it was really bad for the country, including the issue of overall surveillance of us as citizens. The government's access to data, and you know, and we see it accelerating with artificial intelligence and the breakdown of the safety net that was around our personal data, I think government, as I've said multiple times, regardless of what party is in power, is that our responsibility as citizens of this country is to question government. And I think it's getting increasingly more difficult.
Let's go to this letter from Joan, who says, there is no problem spending money. Trump is taking it from health and safety programs and spending it in other places like military, National Guard, ICE, secret police, and what is that? What are those marks? I want to say ellipses, but no.
Parentheses?
Thank you very much. Yes.
Wow. Calling them forgettable words for 1,000, well, Alex.
What would you do with that?
Yeah. Punctuation for 500. In other places like military, National Guard, ICE, and birthday parades, et cetera, and that letter from Joan. Then we...
Joe, I think the letter is really right. They're spending money where they want to. But what worries me is that they're also not fairly spending money as directed by Congress. So they're... I think a great example is if you look at even how research is being funded across the country right now, where red states are being funded to do research and that money was taken away from blue states, which was never the way. I can tell you when I was at DHS, it was never the way that we never looked at states as either or red or blue, and we would never have not followed both the intent and law that Congress laid out in the appropriations bill.
We're going over to the Lockbox studio in just a moment. A quick letter from Elizabeth, who says, money is the weapon of power and control. Controlling the money makes for an uninformed public and no justice as we peons are left to scramble. We welcome your letters, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. We will continue our conversation and finish up our roundtable discussion after a brief check-in in Lockbox Land and see how things are going over there. We'll be back right after this. Thanks so much to Sarah and Ray for their great job and for doing the heavy lifting here and getting people to know what we're up to this morning and to really talk about how important all of this is. And, of course, thanks to you for actually calling us and checking in and going online, WAMC.org, to help the Lockbox and to help keep this radio station going. WAMC.org, WAMC.org. We continue with the panel and we'll wrap up our discussion before we go over to a couple of other things. We're going to hear from Mary Louise Kelly from NPR talking about her new podcast, which comes out every Thursday, and it's on national security. And certainly, you know, we need to know about this stuff. Right, Bob? This is your world.
Yes.
Everybody's world.
Yeah. It is. It is everybody's world. That's right. All right. Let's go to new topics. And again, we welcome you, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. RFK Jr. has released his childhood health report. This is something that had been promised for a while. And for all of Health Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr.'s high-profile moves over the last few weeks, a new report from the Make American Healthy Again Commission he leads, released Tuesday, arrived with little fanfare or teeth. This from the New York Times. The White House Commission report, which outlines strategies to combat childhood chronic disease, lands at a time when the health secretary has plunged the nation's public health apparatus into chaos. It comes days after Mr. Kennedy testified before the Senate Finance Committee in a combative hearing, and about 2 weeks after he ousted the director of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. The New York Times obtained a draft of the report in August. The final report is largely unchanged and does not always clearly explain how the government will implement its recommendations. In the report, Mr. Kennedy has returned to his usual talking points that American children are sick, they are stressed and screen addicted, and that corporate interests and prescription medications are to blame. It is the clearest articulation yet of how the administration plans to carry out the aims of the MAHA movement, Make America Healthy Again. Yet even with the familiar rhetoric, the report is very likely to disappoint, some corners of Mr. Kennedy's coalition. It demonstrates both the ambitions and limits of the agenda. It stops short of calling for direct restrictions on pesticides and ultra-processed foods, which Mr. Kennedy has called major threats. The strategy suggests collaboration, not confrontation, with the food and agriculture industries, saying that the government will back precision agricultural techniques to help farmers use less pesticides. After the Times reported on the draft, some members of the movement expressed frustration at what they saw as signs of Mr. Kennedy's capitulations to these industries. Anna.
Well, I mean, one great way to prevent diseases in children, I hear, is vaccine. So I would love to see him believe in vaccines first. And even a broken clock is right twice a day. I would love to see.
Second time we said that in the studio this morning. Go
oh,
ahead.
Good. Yes. Oh, good. Well, yeah. Today it's that I would love to see less chemicals in our food. And I would love to see some restrictions on children's screen time. But I don't really support most of the other things that are, coming out of the MAHA movement. So, yeah, I until he believes in vaccines and isn't spreading misinformation when there are measles outbreaks, I'm skeptical.
I mean, one of the things that I found interesting, Mark, was that this was a report that was supposed to tell us everything that they were going to do. And yet, as the Times points out, much of this had already been announced. They've already claimed victory on some of this, including establishing an infertility training center, cracking down on food dyes, and relaunching the presidential fitness test. So in some ways, it was a progress report as opposed to a report of an agenda moving forward.
I think the issue with RFK Jr. is there's some confusion over vaccinations, and it has to be clear that polio and measles, you should be getting those vaccinations, but not all vaccinations are the same. COVID is a whole different ballgame. There were people who were fired because they did not get a COVID shot. And my issue with COVID is there's no long-term testing. In fact, we now, there's Albany Med has created a department of long COVID for people that are suffering from COVID shots. So there needs to be clarity on what vaccinations are really useful and helpful. And I believe that, and it's reasonable to make them mandatory when you're going sending kids to school and they're going to be mixing with a bunch of other kids. But ultimately, the decisions are between the person and the patient and the doctor. And so I'm a little leery when government says you must do this. But I think RFK Jr. is responsible for the lack of clarity on vaccinations. He's not totally against vaccinations, which people say. That's not the case. But the lack of clarity is on him, really. And I really like the focus on getting dyes out of the food, you know, processed food. He's really put the focus on health in a way that it hasn't been in a long time. It's just we're going against some pretty powerful industries when we're talking about these things, because about 5 years ago, I decided I wanted to lose weight, and I changed my diet completely. You know, I went to vegetable omelets in the morning, and I lost 7 or 8 pounds for 4 straight months. So I lost 30 pounds, and I kept it off. And it really struck me how, you know, acting alone with good nutrition, you can really make a difference in your life. And that's, I'd love to see more focus on individuals being really smart about their health because we have too many overweight people in our country, and it's a shame because it has really some substantial implications.
You know, I just want to go back to what you said earlier about the vaccines being between the patient and the doctor. But if the doctor believes, and many do, that you should get, let's say, a COVID vaccine, the problem is that has been made extremely difficult to do for many Americans in this country at this point. And if it were as simple as, okay, you need a prescription, you go. And now we're getting into issues of insurance coverage, of availability, of how we get it, when we get it. I mean, this is anecdotal, and I apologize for this, but I right now know probably 10 people who have active cases of horrible COVID. So you look at that and you think, that taps me on the shoulder and says, I would like to get a booster now. And even going as far as what you're saying, of going to my doctor and saying, I would like to get a booster. But then where do you go to get it? How does that happen? And how does it all work out, I think, is something that for many Americans is troubling.
Well, your issue is availability if they do choose to. But are you arguing with the idea that it should be their choice?
I'm not arguing that it should be a choice. Well, I'm arguing that I think a choice is being made from you if you're making it more difficult to get it. I mean,
I'm for availability, but ultimately it should be their decision.
Well, I think yes, I agree. I mean, I think if I decide that I want an update on my flu shot, yes, that should be my decision. I don't necessarily believe that should be mandated. Although when you start talking about schools and groups of people, I question that. I wince, and maybe even curl up into the fetal position when I hear that they want students in the state of Florida to go into school without any vaccines.
Right. Which could be a death sentence for those other students. Joe, you started with the question of, this document was supposed to tell us what they're going to do. And they told us really loud and clear, they're not going to do much. It looks like some of the more positive aspects that Kennedy had expounded have been rolled back in frankly I think because of corporate farming and the influence of the chemical and pesticide industry. But this is all interconnected, though. This is the thing that gets me. Let's talk about nutrition. Everybody, Mark, I love your comments about nutrition. Think about it, though. You have to have access to food. You have to have access to healthy food. You've got to have access to health care. You got to have access in the rural areas to rural hospitals and medical centers. I mean, this is all tied up. At the same time, we're coming out with Make America Healthy Again slogans. We're cutting things like SNAP. We're cutting things like research, which actually would help answer some of the questions that I think are really valid, like you just laid out. What are the long-term implications of COVID? Well, that's research. And all of these elements are being cut. I will also note that before I came on the show, I did a little bit of research, and I'm like, okay, what are the key elements in that are affecting the rate of death in children in this country? Gun violence is up there. Motor vehicle accidents, self-harm are up there. Nowhere in this document are we talking about the mental health crisis. I will also note that they did spend a bunch of time about, quote, improving fertility, which just made me cringe at some of the language that they use, because I just feel like we have a government document that sort of makes the handmaiden's tale look passive. But when you look at a number of these different policies, like the fact that elements of the Big Beautiful Bill actually are putting the family farms and the organic farming industry at a significant disadvantage, if not completely out of out of business. There are so many things that are being done that are running contrary to this that I don't have a lot of faith that this document is anything other than another government report that'll go on a shelf.
I do want to get to a couple of letters here, and we go to Marion, who says, is the panelist blaming COVID vaccines for long COVID? Does he have any basis for that? I was hearing about long COVID before the vaccine even came out. Is the panel going to allow statements like this without any challenge? We leave yeah. that up to you. No, but you're right. And also,
just to say that there's people that didn't have COVID but got the COVID shot that have serious implications.
That's not long COVID.
Well, it's extended over a longer period of time. Yeah, it is.
I think long COVID is when you have COVID symptoms that don't go away. And
right.
So I think we should study it. This seems to be a real problem. But I think that the vaccine, there have been studies that show that it has prevented millions of deaths. And so I don't think that we should necessarily have a correlation between the COVID vaccine and long COVID. We should be doing research on it, which it would be great if research was funded so that we could do things like that. So we could learn how to treat long COVID, because I agree that long COVID is a terrible thing.
And that was the problem with COVID, is there was no long-term research on it. Yeah, people,
well, the money's gone.
I mean, at the time of the outbreak, we really didn't know.
Did we have time?
And the rules changed. Like Fauci was saying, well, masks are only for healthcare workers. Well, that changed. Then cloth masks are fine. Then that changed. And then we scrubbed down all these subway trains every night, but we realized COVID is an airborne disease. So there's a lot of things we didn't know when COVID broke out, but there are a number of people who were forced to lose their jobs because they wouldn't take a shot. And that's not right. That's not the same as measles or polio, because we know the long-term implications of that.
No, but if you have a new outbreak of a disease, what are you supposed to do? Wait until you have all of the science before you act, because that could take years.
And then millions of more people would have died.
And this is the problem of the fear I have with the weakening of CDC and HHS, is that we as a country are not going to be able to handle Mother Nature's twists and turns. Were mistakes made? Yes. And as a government and as a people, we should go back and see what worked and what didn't. But the idea of saying that we're not going to do research now, because Kennedy has these feelings about what health should be, that's good science. I have a real fundamental problem with that.
No, I think everybody's for good science, but some people
think... No, they're not. No, Mark, I don't believe that's the case. I do not believe that they are for good science.
But I've seen it. Some people say, I have the unique observation of you have to agree with my science, as if scientists can't have debates. And there's a lot of really healthy debates going on in the science community.
Right, which is really, thank you for raising that, because that is, that's exactly the gold standard for science. Is the peered review process, these constant debates and questioning that go on, and the iterative changes that then go on, that's how good science works. So that is absolutely critically important. But when you kill all of the funding for that, when you take away and destroy some of the best research that was going on in places like Harvard. Let's just pick on Harvard. For all of the warts that Harvard has, and I've talked about on the show before, they have done incredibly groundbreaking work that has now completely stopped because the president of the United States has a dislike for the university and has targeted them.
Chris writes, please correct the record and say that Albany Med has a department to study long COVID, which is caused by COVID, not the COVID vaccine.
we go to this letter from Kristen, who says, wouldn't it be great? I take two. From Kristen, between patient and doctor, wouldn't it be great if a woman's health was only between a woman and her doctor? That is from Kristen. Fran writes, COVID vaccines aren't part of the mandated vaccines for children to attend schools. And then we check in. They're coming in fast and furious. And this will be the last one because we're running out of time. Long COVID was identified in March 2020 before COVID vaccines available. Folks, that will do it for us this morning. My thanks to Anna Markowitz, Bob Griffin, and Mark Grimm. And thank you for your letters, and thank you for your support to the Lockbox. We'll continue that effort as we go on this morning. Mary Louise Kelly coming up next to talk about her new podcast. All of that and much more after this short break.